The choice of a mate and the quality of your home and family life determines your success as a human being as much or more than any other factor. One of the qualities of the fully functioning, fully mature, fully actualizing personality is the ability to enter into long-term intimate relationships with other people and maintain those relationships throughout life. The men and women with the healthiest personalities, those who are the most together as human beings, are those who seem to have the greatest capacity to maintain long-term loving relationships. Your relationships are a direct expression of the person you really are. The law of correspondence says that your outer world of relationships will correspond exactly to your inner world of thought and feeling. If your inner world is happy and loving, your outer world of relationships will be happy and satisfying. Benjamin Disraeli, Prime Minister of England in the 19th century, once said, "No success in public life can compensate for failure in the home." If you are truly mature, your personal relationships will take precedence over everything else. And as you change and improve as a person, your relationships will change and improve automatically and effortlessly. You get out of relationships exactly what you put into them. The more of yourself that you put into a relationship, the more love, the more satisfaction, and the more joy you will get out of a relationship. Men and women are born incomplete, and we need each other to become whole as human beings. We are born with complementary qualities and characteristics. Each of us needs the other in order to fulfill our destiny as a human being. Happy relationships go hand in hand with peace of mind, long life, health, happiness, and abundance. On the other hand, men and women who live alone have as many as 5 times the incidence of life-threatening and degenerative diseases of men and women who live happily together. It's been said over and over that your self-esteem, how much you like yourself, lies at the root of healthy personality and happiness. High self-esteem goes hand in hand with high performance and success in every area of life, while low self-esteem seems to accompany most failure and frustration. The first half of self-esteem is the purely emotional component, the way you feel about yourself, separate and apart from anyone and anything else. The second half of your self-esteem is the degree of competence that you feel you have in the important areas of your life. We call this performance-based self-esteem. When you feel that you're good at something, that you perform well in a particular area, you experience high self-esteem, which reinforces the other component of self-esteem, your sense of personal value. Each one is dependent on the other. Because relationships are so important to us as human beings, in order for us to enjoy a sustained feeling of self-esteem, we must know in our hearts that we are capable of entering into and maintaining a positive, healthy, and constructive loving relationship with a member of the opposite sex. A feeling of inferiority or incompetence in the area of relationships is a real destroyer of self-esteem and human personality. Everything that we learn and practice that enables us to get along better with the important people in our lives causes our self-esteem to go up, causes us to feel more competent and complete, and enables us to more readily become everything we're capable of becoming in the other areas of our lives. There's a direct relationship between the quality of your loving relationships and your level of self-esteem and self-acceptance. You can only like yourself to the degree to which you fully accept yourself, and your level of self-acceptance is largely determined by how much you are accepted by other people. Most of us grow up, from infancy, with a form of conditional acceptance and often rejection and disapproval from our parents. As adults, we seek the unconditional love and acceptance of others in order to compensate for what we feel we lacked as children, and our mental health depends on it. We can never feel free to like ourselves as adults until we totally accept ourselves, both our strengths and our weaknesses. And the key to self-acceptance is being accepted unconditionally by at least one other person whom we respect and admire. Self-acceptance, in turn, requires self-awareness. We need to fully understand who we are and why we act and think and feel the way we do. We need to achieve some clarity concerning the formative experiences of our life. We need to understand how and why we've become the person that we have become. It's only when we achieve a high level of self-awareness that we can move to a higher level of self-acceptance. And it's only with a high level of self-acceptance that we can enjoy self-esteem. The greatest psychological problem of the 20th century is guilt. Feelings of guilt arise from a sense of worthlessness as a result of destructive criticism and mistakes that we feel we've made in the past. Most of us feel that we have done and said some foolish and stupid things, some of which have hurt other people, and we feel a sense of remorse and unhappiness as a result. We can only free ourselves from these negative feelings by telling somebody about what it is that we did or said. This is a form of catharsis or cleansing that liberates us and allows us to get on with the rest of our lives. Honest self-disclosure is sometimes scary, but it is the basic precondition for mental health. When you can disclose and express yourself freely to at least one other person, you can then understand yourself and develop a higher level of self-awareness. As you understand yourself and why you think and feel the way you do, as you become more self-aware, you move to a higher level of self-acceptance. When you finally accept yourself unconditionally, you can then move to self-esteem and self-regard. Dr. Nathaniel Brandon says that your self-esteem is your reputation with yourself. You can only improve your reputation with yourself to the degree to which you can let go and speak openly and honestly to at least one other person. One of the great purposes of marriage and intimate relationships is to give each of us the opportunity to evolve and grow to our full capacity. In a fully trusting relationship, we feel perfectly free to tell the other person anything that we've done in the past or anything that we're thinking and feeling in the present. By doing this, we soon learn that there's no need for us to feel anxious or guilty or self-doubting. We develop a deeper understanding of our own humanity. As a result, we become more tolerant, more accepting, and more compassionate toward the human frailties of other people. We fill out and develop parts of our personality that would have lain dormant in the absence of a fully loving relationship. A psychologist once said that everything that we do in life is either to get love or to compensate for the lack of love. We seek to be loved, accepted, and understood completely and unconditionally by at least one other person. It's only when our emotional need for security has been satisfied that we feel free to turn our minds and our hearts to accomplishing what's possible for us in our external life. Someone once said that love is like money. If you have an ample supply of the quality and quantity of love that you desire, you don't think about it very much. But if your supply is cut off for any period of time, you think about nothing else. The cruelest punishment in prison is to lock a person away from all other human beings, to put a person in solitary confinement. Being deprived of human contact, of human interaction, is the worst thing that we can do to another person. On the other hand, the very finest and best thing that can happen to you as a human being is to evolve and develop personally to the point where you attract into your life the ideal, loving relationship that enables you to enjoy the happiness and joy for which you are created. Everything that was talked about in the previous sessions on developing a success personality are applicable to our relationships with members of the opposite sex. In addition, there are a great number of other things that we can learn to do or stop doing that can dramatically improve the way that we get along with the important other person in our life. Let's start off with 6 keys to success in relationships. The first key is that similarities attract. You'll always be the happiest and the most compatible with another person whose interests, tastes, and values are similar to yours. The law of attraction says that you will be attracted to a person whose fundamental underlying attitudes and values are in harmony with your own. The most important areas where compatibility seems to be essential in marriages and relationships is in attitudes toward money, how it's earned, how it's saved, and how it's spent. Also important are attitudes with regard to children, whether or not to have them and how to raise them, as well as attitudes toward sex, religion, and politics. In every case, you'll be most happy and most compatible with a person whose fundamental beliefs and values are most similar to your own. Most of the arguments and disruptive influences in marriages and relationships revolve around fundamental disagreements about the most important issues in life, especially money, sex, and children. The second key to success in relationships is that opposites attract, but only in temperament. Nature always demands balance and harmony. And the place where balance is most necessary is in the area of temperament between and among two people. There's a simple test of compatible temperaments that you can use and apply to all of your relationships, especially your intimate, loving relationships, and that is the conversation test. In a relationship where you are compatible with the other person temperamentally, there will be an easy ebb and flow of conversation. Each person will be able to talk all that he or she needs to talk, and each person will have the opportunity to listen all that he or she needs to listen. This is very important. Each person has a certain amount of talking that he or she must do in order to remain mentally healthy and whole. If people don't get the opportunity to do all of their talking with the person with whom they're involved, they'll seek to fulfill their conversational needs somewhere else. Almost all affairs in marriages begin as the result of a need to communicate more fully with another human being. When people are temperamentally balanced, 90% of the time they spend together will be filled with easy conversation, going back and forth. The other 10% will be filled with comfortable silences. However, if one person needs to talk 70% of the time and only listen 20% of the time, and the other person also needs to talk 70% of the time and only listen 20% of the time, there will be a clash over what is called airtime. They will be continually struggling over who is going to get to talk the most, who's going to fulfill their talk needs at the expense of the other. In this type of a relationship, often there will be one person who loves the more and one person who loves the less. Always the person who loves the more will bite his or her lip and give in to allow the person who loves the less to do all the talking he or she wants to do. This is, however, only a temporary solution. It inevitably leads to a deep feeling of frustration and unhappiness on the part of the person who loves the more and who is not getting an opportunity to express himself or herself fully enough. Another example of incompatibility would be when both parties only need to talk 30% of the time and are comfortable listening 60 to 70% of the time. In this case, you would have 40% of the time filled with what are called uncomfortable silences. The two would just sit there with very little to say, feeling uncomfortable but not knowing how to break the silence. This, too, is an example of temperamental incompatibility. This conversation test can be applied to your relationships with any of your friends at any level and of either sex. Your very best friends are those with whom you have easy conversations and easy silences. These are the ones with whom you are most compatible. But it's most important that you be conversationally compatible with your mate or spouse if you want to be happy in your relationship. The third key to successful relationships is total commitment on the part of both people. Total commitment requires a heartfelt determination to make the relationship successful. If the two are compatible in their basic values and attitudes and are temperamentally balanced with each other, it's much easier for them to make a lifelong, lasting commitment. A total commitment means that neither party ever considers or discusses the possibility of separating, breaking up, or divorcing. A total commitment requires that you burn all your mental and emotional bridges and refuse to consider any other option except making this relationship successful. Many people avoid making a total commitment to a relationship, even a marriage, because they feel that they have been hurt in previous relationships. They feel that if they keep their emotional back door open, as it were, they always have an escape route. Unfortunately, this lack of commitment leads almost invariably to creating the exact situation that the individual fears. The relationship gradually deteriorates as one or both parties continue to think of separation as the solution to the problems that inevitably arise between two people. Scott Peck, in his book The Road Less Traveled, gives a definition of love which I think is ideal. He says, "Love is the total commitment to the full development of the potential of the other." When you truly love another person, you want that person to fulfill his or her full potential, to become everything that he or she is capable of becoming. If there's the slightest reluctance or hesitation in creating or supporting every opportunity for the other person to grow and develop, what you have might be a relationship, but it is probably not really love. The fourth key to successful relationships is liking. It's more important and more satisfying to genuinely like your partner than to be in love. The reason for this is that in a long-term relationship, people may fall in and out of love. The amount of emotion that each feels for the other may vary with the passing of time. But if the two people like and respect each other, the relationship can endure indefinitely. When one person stops liking or respecting the other person for any reason, then the relationship is usually over. Many couples fall in love and then break up and never speak to each other again because they never took the time to fall in like, to learn how to genuinely like and respect the other person as an individual rather than just as a romantic partner. Marriages and relationships often don't work out, but if they are based on liking and respect, the two parties afterwards can still communicate and interact on an adult level without the negativity and often the feeling of hatred that goes with relationships that ended where no liking or respect ever existed. The best way to tell if you are in the right relationship for you is what I call the best friend test. In the ideal relationship, your mate will be your best friend. There'll be no one in the world that you would rather be with, share with, talk to, spend time with, or tell things to than your spouse. If for any reason you don't feel that your spouse or mate is your best friend, that you don't feel that you'd rather be with him or her than anyone else, it's a good indication that something is amiss in the relationship. In every interview of couples who have been together for a long time, both the man and the woman describe the other as their very best friend in the world. The fifth key to successful relationships is that similar self-concepts attract and are most compatible. You will always tend to be attracted to and to be most happy with a person who is just about as happy and as positive as you are. The general tone of the relationship, the general level of optimism versus negativity, is a very good indication of the compatibility of self-concepts. Interestingly enough, people with negative self-concepts will be attracted to each other. They'll marry and settle down and will be quite content together for many years, if not for life, even though their relationship is based on the fact that they are both negative toward many things. A good test is to give your mate a score on a scale of 1 to 100 and measure what percentage of the time he or she is usually positive and optimistic versus what percentage of the time he or she is usually negative or pessimistic. Then, give yourself the same test. You'll find that you are the most comfortable with a person who is pretty much as happy or as unhappy as you are. On the other hand, if two people get into a relationship and one of them is much happier or much more negative than the other, they will have created the conditions for all kinds of conflict and unhappiness later. Most relationships and marriages that break up do so as the result of self-concepts being out of balance. The sixth key to success in relationships is communication. The number one reason for the success of marriages is that the two partners communicate well with each other. The number one reason for the failure of relationships is usually poor communication. In order to have a good level of communication in a relationship, you require both a high quantity and a high quality of unbroken time with each other. Couples need to get away alone together and just spend long stretches of time keeping the communication channels open. Whenever two people get so busy that they stop taking time to talk, you can be sure that there are troubles ahead. Communicating requires both speaking and listening, much along the lines of what we discussed in previous sessions. But good communicating between a man and a woman also requires an understanding of the major differences between men and women. Basically, men are direct and women are indirect. Men are more focused on results and completion or closure than women. Women are more concerned about relationships and the process of communication than men are. This can often lead to fundamental misunderstandings. A simple example would be the case of a man or a woman on a car trip who've been on the road for 2 or 3 hours. As they drive past a McDonald's, the woman says suggestively, "Honey, are you thirsty?" The man, without looking to the side, simply says, "Nope," and continues driving. The woman bites her lip and feels hurt at his insensitivity, and he doesn't even know that anything has happened. In her indirect way, she was saying, "I'm thirsty. Why don't we stop and get something to drink?" However, because of the way she phrased it, it went over his head completely. To a man, going shopping is a simple process with an expected result. You go in, you purchase what you came for, and you leave. End of story. For many women, however, shopping is a social process. A woman doesn't necessarily even have to buy anything. Shopping is a sensory experience, and when a woman is engaged in it with another person, it becomes a social event in which the communication that takes place is as important, if not more important, than the reason for the shopping trip in the first place. This is something that is very hard for men to understand. Because men are oriented toward closure, when a woman begins discussing a problem she's having, the man will almost immediately respond with what he considers to be the logical solution. He'll say, "Why don't you do this?" or "Why don't you do that?" And then he'll probably go back to reading his newspaper. What the man doesn't realize is that the woman is usually not even asking for a solution, nor does she want his advice or his brilliant recommendations. What she wants is an opportunity to discuss the situation, to process the problem through dialoguing about it with the man in her life. She probably already knows what she's going to do or not do. What she seeks is an opportunity to communicate, using this particular situation or problem as the basis for the conversation. One of the things that men can do to improve the communication with the women in their lives is simply to refrain from giving advice unless it is clear that this is what she wants. It's probably going to be ignored anyway, and it's usually neither necessary nor appreciated. The question that you always need to ask to maintain a successful relationship is, what's important here? What is important is not winning the argument or being right, but maintaining the quality of the relationship. What is important is that two people continue to love and respect each other and live together in peace, harmony, and happiness. If you continually ask over and over, what's important here? You'll be more likely to keep your relationship on track. One of the best ways to build and maintain a successful relationship is to practice the golden rule of relationships. Ask yourself on a regular basis, what would it be like to be married to me? Or, what would it be like if my mate treated me the way I treat him or her? If you do unto your mate what you would like to see done unto you, and if you refrain from doing or saying anything that you would not like your mate to do or say to you, you'll be far more aware of the impact of your actions and behaviors on your relationship. And awareness is really the key. Remember, I said that life is the study of attention. If you pay attention to the small things in your relationship, the big things will take care of themselves. There are probably 1,000 reasons why relationships don't work out, but I think that you can boil them down to basically 6 major problems. These 6 difficulties in relationships seem to lie at the root of most arguments, disagreements, and divorces. All of them have to do with the self-esteem and self-concept of one or both of the parties in the relationship. The first major problem in relationships is lack of commitment. This is demonstrated in what is called the go halfway relationship or marriage. Instead of full and total commitment, there is only partial or half commitment. When each party says, you go halfway and I'll go halfway, as soon as one party decides to go only 49% of the way, a split opens up in the relationship. And what we know about this kind of split is that it tends to grow wider rather than narrower. You see examples of this go-halfway relationship when a couple gets married, but each one keeps a separate bank account and all of the household expenses are divided up equally. I know of one example where household expenses were divided down to the penny, even including the cost of a postage stamp to send in the utility bill. Another form of lack of commitment is what is called the marriage contract or a prenuptial agreement. These agreements are remarkable. The first paragraph of one of these agreements states that the two parties, being very much in love and planning to live together happily for all the days of their life, are hereby entering into this agreement. The rest of the prenuptial agreement details at great length how the property will be split when they separate. They are, in effect, planning the details of the separation even before they get into the marriage. When one or the other party is not willing to commit totally to the other, it triggers feelings of rejection and unworthiness. It makes one or both parties feel that they're not good enough for the other to commit totally and unequivocally to them. The way that you overcome the lack of commitment is, as I said earlier, to commit yourself wholeheartedly and unequivocally to the relationship. Get in with your whole heart and never consider the possibility of the relationship failing. If, through no fault of your own, the relationship doesn't work out, at least it will not be because you are only in it half-heartedly. The second major problem in relationships is trying to change the other person or expecting the other person to change. This is another form of rejection. This is another way of saying you are not good enough for me the way you are. Whenever you try to change another person, you imply that he or she is unworthy, and you trigger in him or her a feeling of anger and resentment. The fact is that people do not change very much. As that great American philosopher Flip Wilson said, what you seize is what you get. If the person you are considering marrying is not what you want to get, the time to do something about it is before you get married, not afterwards. The solution to this problem of attempting to change the other, trying to get the other person to lose weight, quit smoking, exercise, become more positive, or anything else, is simply to accept the person as he or she is. If you cannot accept the behaviors and the personality of the other person, that should be a very good indication for you of whether or not this is the right relationship for you to get into or to stay in for the rest of your life. The third problem in relationships is jealousy. And jealousy is always experienced in the mind and heart of the person feeling the emotion. Shakespeare called jealousy the green-eyed monster. It is a terribly negative emotion that arises from a feeling of low self-esteem and personal inadequacy. The person who feels jealous feels that nobody could ever love me, being the kind of person I am. This type of individual has usually suffered from destructive criticism in childhood and negative experiences with the opposite sex as an adult. If a person never received the unconditional love of his or her parents, or even worse, if the parents rejected or disapproved of the child during the time he or she was growing up, when that person becomes an adult, he or she will be very susceptible to not being fully loved and accepted by others. The antidote to jealousy is to realize that it has nothing to do with the other person. It has to do only with your own low self-esteem. When your self-esteem is high enough, you'll realize that nothing that anybody does or doesn't do can affect your value as a person. The fourth problem in relationships is self-pity, which is feeling sorry for yourself for something that your partner has either done or not done, either to or for you. Usually, people who feel self-pity learned it from one of their parents, who also practiced self-pity as a method of interaction at home. Often people will experience self-pity because their partner will be so busy or happy with his or her work or career that the person experiencing the self-pity feels left out. The antidote is not to get your partner to do or not do something, but to get so busy with your own goals that you don't have time to feel sorry for yourself. Remember, you're responsible for your own emotions, your own happiness or unhappiness. No one makes you feel anything. If you experience self-pity, it is because you choose to feel sorry for yourself. The fifth problem in relationships is negative expectations, which is expecting the other person to do something to disappoint you. What we now know about expectations is that our expectations tend to be fulfilled. If we expect good things to happen, we'll seldom be disappointed. And if we expect our partner to let us down, we'll seldom be disappointed in that either. The most wonderful words that one person can say to another are, "I love you and I believe in you." Many of the most successful men and women who have ever lived owe their success to the unshakable positive expectations of their mate. The rule is to always expect the best of your partner. Always tell him or her that you have complete confidence and faith in his or her ability to do anything that he or she puts his or her mind to. It's wonderful to go off to work in the morning knowing that the most important person in your life believes in you absolutely. And it's wonderful to come home at night to a person who has complete faith in your ability to succeed, no matter what the obstacles. The sixth major problem in relationships is incompatibility. Incompatibility is a very sensitive subject which many people don't like to discuss. However, it's one of the most common problems that arise in relationships and one of the most common reasons why people are unhappy in their marriages. Usually, when two people meet and fall in love, it's because of the things that they find they have in common. However, as the years pass and as people grow and mature and change, they often grow apart. They form new values, new attitudes, and new opinions. What they thought and felt was important and worthwhile when they first met, they may no longer consider to be relevant to their lives. The very first sign that a couple is no longer compatible is that the laughter goes out of the relationship. The second sign is that the conversation goes out of the relationship. The home is no longer hallmarked by love, but is a cold and stiff place to be. Each person preoccupies himself or herself with either work or the children or something else. Many people who are unhappy in their marriages plunge themselves into their work, working 12 and 14 hours a day so that they don't have to go home to an unsatisfying relationship. One of the most powerful ways to put love back into a relationship is to realize that love is a verb. Love is an action word. Love requires that you do the things that a loving person would do if you wish to feel the emotion that a person in love would feel. This means that you may be able to act your way back into loving the person you may have fallen out of love with. We learn to love another person by doing loving things with and for that person. Small attentions, little favors, kindnesses, gifts, and other things that make the other person happy actually cause us to love the person more. when we stop doing these things, it's very possible to begin to slip out of love. We generate emotions in ourselves by doing things consistent with those emotions over and over again until they kindle into flames. You can put the love back into your relationship by starting to do again the things that you did during courtship. If you start to be more caring, more attentive, more understanding, and more sympathetic, you may find that your feelings toward the other person begin to change for the better. You can act your way back into love. Incompatibility is one of the most common of all reasons for the breakdown of any kind of relationship. The average adult has to go out with many members of the opposite sex during the courtship years to find even one with whom he or she is compatible. Why should it be so surprising that two people would evolve and grow and develop into different people from where they started? Why should it be so surprising that two people can become incompatible? Often, you'll see couples sitting in restaurants eating quietly and not talking to each other. Or you'll see people driving along together staring out into traffic without conversing. These signs are indications that the couple has become incompatible. The best thing to do if two people have become incompatible is simply to accept it. William James of Harvard said that the first step in dealing with any difficulty is to be willing to have it so. Much unhappiness and even psychosomatic illness is caused by the psychological problem of denial or refusing to face the fact that something is wrong in your relationship. Denial or resistance causes internal stress and tension. The unwillingness to deal with something so embarrassing and so threatening to one's self-esteem as a failed relationship is a major cause of degenerative illnesses, insomnia, headaches, and outbursts of negative emotions such as irritability and anger. These are all symptoms of an underlying cause which may be incompatibility in the relationship. One of the most useful exercises in dealing with any challenge in life is to ask yourself, is this a fact or is this a problem? If it's a problem, it's amenable to a solution. There's something you can do about it and you can apply your intelligence to finding a solution. However, if it's a fact, the smartest thing to do is to accept it. Facts are like the weather. There's nothing that you can do about them except to incorporate them into your view of reality and make provision for them. Many people cause themselves an enormous amount of unnecessary unhappiness by confusing the fact of incompatibility with the problem of incompatibility. When the fire goes out of a relationship, when the ashes go cold and incompatibility sets in, then it's time for one or both parties to face the facts squarely and honestly and then do something about it. The bottom line is that based on my work with thousands of individuals and couples, the most foolish thing you can ever do is stay in a bad relationship because you think that somehow it's going to hurt or upset someone else if you leave it. The very best thing that you can do is to be perfectly selfish emotionally. If you're not happy and you can't save the situation, then at least please yourself in all things. Remember, you can never make anyone else happy by suffering unhappiness yourself. Only happy people can make others happy. Never sacrifice yourself on the altar of someone else's happiness. You end up achieving neither your own happiness nor the happiness of the other person. The most important thing in life is love. The security of a loving relationship is perhaps the most wonderful thing that a man or a woman can experience in the course of their lives. You should do everything possible to build and maintain a loving relationship with another person, including listening, expressing gratitude and appreciation, treating the other person with kindness, courtesy, gentleness, patience, and especially tolerance. You should make every effort to build a loving relationship within which you can live indefinitely. But if it doesn't work out, have the courage and character to accept that nothing in human life is ever perfect. Have the honesty with yourself to accept that the kindest thing that you can do for someone else is to achieve your own happiness. If you do that, you'll be living true to yourself and true to the most important people in your life. Perhaps the most important and enduring relationship that you ever enter into begins when you bring a child into the world. Income, jobs, friendships, health, and even marriages may come and go, but your role as a parent lasts as long as you live. The impact of your parenting can affect your child and your children's children down the generations. Parenting is probably the most profound responsibility that an adult can ever take on. As it happens, no one is born with the skills of successful parenting. We all start off as complete amateurs. Fortunately, we can learn an enormous amount about how to be a good and effective parent by reading and seeking advice from friends, relatives, doctors, and experts in the field. There are many fine books, magazines, and articles that have been written that can give us insights which will help us tremendously in being the kind of parents that we want to be. The first question we should ask is, what is the role of parenting? I believe that the main role of parenting is to love and nurture your children and to encourage feelings of high self-esteem and self-confidence in them. If a parent raises his or her children with high self-esteem and self-confidence, with an eagerness to go out and take on the world, then the parent has fulfilled his or her responsibility in the highest possible sense. On the other hand, if the parent gives a child everything of a material nature but raises the child lacking in self-confidence and self-esteem, then to that degree the parent has failed to fulfill his or her primary responsibility. It's been said that the average adult spends the second 50 years of his or her life getting over the first five. Abraham Maslow suggested there are two types of needs that we strive to fulfill, deficiency needs and potential or being needs. The child that is raised without a sufficient amount of love or support tends to seek it all his life, striving to compensate for his deficiencies rather than striving to realize his potential. Perhaps the kindest and best thing that a parent can do is to give the child the emotional support and sustenance necessary for the child to grow and thrive, feeling loved and supported totally by the most important people in his or her life. I mentioned earlier that healthy personality in the growing child is in direct proportion to the quality and quantity of love that the child receives. In my experience, all parents want the very best for their children. All parents sincerely want to love and support and raise their children in the best possible way. Why is it then that so many children grow up feeling insufficiently loved? Why is it that parents fail to give their children the full quality and quantity of love that they need for healthy growth? I believe that there are two primary reasons for this failure to extend a sufficient amount of love. First, the parents don't love themselves. Parents with low self-esteem have great difficulty giving more love to their children than they have for themselves. The second reason is that many parents believe that their children exist to fulfill their expectations. One of the primary causes of friction between parents and children is the parents' feeling or perception that the children are failing to measure up to what the parents expected them to be or do. Many parents have the mistaken notion that their children are a form of property, and that they are only behaving properly when they are doing and saying what their parents feel is proper for them to do or say. If the child deviates from the parents' expectations, the parents often respond by being critical and condemnatory, and by withdrawing their love and approval from the child. This leads to the child's perception of love withheld, the primary reason for personality and emotional problems in adulthood. The starting point of raising super kids. This idea is best expressed in the words of Khalil Gibran in his wonderful book, The Prophet. In this book, there's a section on children where Gibran says, "Your children are not your children. They are the sons and daughters of life's longing for itself. They come through you, but are not from you. And though they are with you, yet they belong not to you. You may give them your love, but not your thoughts, for they have their own thoughts. You may house their bodies, but not their souls, for their souls dwell in the house of tomorrow, which you cannot visit, not even in your dreams. You may strive to be like them, but seek not to make them like you. For life goes not backward, nor tarries with yesterday. You are the bows from which your children, as living arrows, are sent forth." When you look at your children as a precious gift that you can only enjoy temporarily, you're much more likely to appreciate your role as a parent. If you celebrate and encourage the unique nature and personality of your child, that child will tend to grow like a flower in the sunshine. The law of correspondence says that your outer world of relationships will tend to be a reflection of your inner world of thought and personality. What your children are and what they become will be very much a reflection of who you are as a person. Whenever you have a problem with your child, look into yourself and ask, "What is there in me that could be causing this situation?" The natural tendency of most parents is to blame and criticize their children when their children do something that the parent finds unacceptable. However, the superior parent looks to himself or herself as the primary source of the child's behavior. Children are almost totally reactive in their earlier years. Their behavior, good or bad, is very much a reaction to the way they're treated by their parents. When the parent begins to look at himself or herself, then real progress is possible in solving difficulties with the child. The most important single ingredient in raising super kids is the amount of love that they receive. Children need love like roses need rain. You can never give a child too much love. The continuous flow of love and approval from the parent to the child is the child's psychological lifeline to emotional and physical health. Almost all problems with children stem back to the child's perception of not being fully loved and accepted by the parent. Lack of love, real or imagined, can have serious consequences. Lack of love can lead to physical, mental, or emotional damage. And this damage stemming from love withheld can have long-term, if not permanent, negative consequences on the life of the child. For example, in the early part of this century, there was a theory of child raising which suggested that the less contact a child had with adults in its first months, the healthier the child would be. It was felt that exposure to too many adults would leave the child open to various infections. Based on this theory, access to newborn children was severely restricted. The children were touched as little as possible. But a terrible thing began to happen. Children being cared for in nurseries where they received very little contact began to shrivel and eventually die. This malady, called miasma, was also called the failure to thrive syndrome. Children deprived of love and touching in the first weeks and months after birth actually lost all desire to live, refused to take nutrition, and just shriveled and died like a leaf that had fallen off a tree. In one orphanage in New York State, 48 out of 50 babies died in a six-month period. Finally, they realized that the children needed the warmth, contact, and love of an adult. When the children began being held and cuddled by the nurses, the miasma began to clear up, and the children began to grow normally. In a famous case reported in one of the psychological journals, a young boy, 3 years old, was left with a babysitter while his parents went out for dinner. Tragically, the parents were both killed in an automobile accident on the way home from the restaurant. The next thing that the little boy knew, he was taken out of his home by the social services department and put into a foster home. He never saw his loving parents again, and he was too young to understand what had happened. He began to act up in the foster home. He wet the bed, he cried, he got into fights with other children, and became a serious behavior problem. As a result, he was moved from foster home to foster home. Simultaneously, a remarkable thing happened. He stopped growing. For the next 4 years, he had nothing but problems in home after home, and at the age of 7, he was still the same physical size that he had been at the age of 3. Then, something wonderful happened. A loving couple met the boy in a foster home and applied to adopt him. They took him home and they began to shower him with warmth and love and affection. They held him, talked to him, took him for walks, and they drowned him with love and unconditional acceptance. And within a few weeks, the little boy started to grow again. In the next 9 months, he grew a full 4 years worth of height and weight, and by the end of the first year with his loving couple, he had reached the normal height and weight for his age. There are countless examples of children who fail to thrive and grow physically as the result of love withheld. There are even more examples of children who fail to grow emotionally and mentally as a result of a breakdown in the quality and quantity of love that they needed for healthy growth. These mental and emotional problems are manifested later in behavioral disturbances, personality disorders, neurosis, psychosis, and serious failures to cope as adults. Love deprivation is surely the most serious problem that a child can suffer during his or her formative years. The starting point of raising super kids is to give them an unbroken flow of unconditional love and acceptance. Make it clear to your child that nothing that he or she does could ever cause you to love him or her less than 100%. The most wonderful gift that a child can receive from a parent is the firm knowledge that the parent loves him or her totally, no matter what he or she does, and no matter what happens. Whenever I have to discipline my children, I always start off by saying, I love you very much, but you can't do this, or you have to stop behaving like that. I always make it very clear that I'm unhappy with the behavior, but not with the child. I've trained my children so that they understand this completely. I used to say to my little girl, Christina, "How much does Daddy love you?" And she would stretch her hands out wide and she would say, "You love me this much." I would then say, "What about when I send you to your bedroom?" She would still say, "You still love me this much." Then I would say, "What about when I spank your hand or take away your toys and then send you to your bedroom?" She would then say, "Daddy, you still love me this much," with her hands outstretched. I would then say, "How can this be?" And she would say, "Daddy, no matter what I do, you always love me 100%. Dr. Ross Campbell, in his wonderful book, How to Really Love Your Child, says that your child is always asking you, one way or the other, "Do you love me?" Sometimes the child misbehaves as a way of checking on whether or not you really love him or her. The older and more mature children become, the more subtle they are about how they ask the question, "Do you love me?" However, the question is always the same. The excellent parent is one who is always dealing with this question. The excellent parent is one who is always expressing to the child in every way possible that, "Yes, I really love you." If you want to raise super kids, tell them that you love them every single day. You can never say, "I love you," to a child too often. Even if your child pretends that he or she doesn't need to hear it, don't you believe it. Every time a child hears the words, "I love you," from his or her parent, the child feels more secure and more free to be himself or herself. Another way to tell your children that you love them is with eye contact. Dr. Campbell says that children have emotional tanks and that they fill their emotional tanks by drinking in love from their parents through their eyes. Whenever you look at a child with loving eye contact, you make the child feel wonderful about himself or herself. From about the age of 6 weeks, children are fascinated by looking into the eyes of someone who is looking at them with warmth, love, and affection. In fact, there's ample evidence to believe that children who do not receive loving eye contact from their parents don't feel truly loved. They feel that something is wrong with their relationships with their parents. They often feel insecure because of this lack of sustained, loving eye contact. In our society, sustained eye contact is usually accompanied by a criticism or by a complaint. We fix our eyes on our children when we're angry with them, but we very seldom fix our eyes on them just as an expression of love. Many children grow up feeling very uncomfortable with eye contact of any kind from their parents because of this negative association. For example, when people have just fallen in love, they sit and stare into each other's eyes for a long time. This is a way that one adult says to another, "I love you." You can try this with your children. You'll be amazed at the impact that sustained, loving eye contact has when you give it to your children if they haven't experienced it for a while. You can also tell your children that you love them with physical contact. Virginia Satir, the well-known family therapist, says that children require 4 hugs per day for survival, 8 hugs per day for health, and 12 hugs per day for growth. Hugging and kissing your children is the most wonderful way to convey to them through touch that you really love and value them. Children who are not hugged and kissed by their parents eventually come to believe that they are not worthy of being hugged and kissed. Research shows that female children and male children are hugged about the same amount during the first year of life. After that, female children continue to receive the same amount of physical affection, but the amount of hugging that a boy child receives drops off dramatically to about 20% of that received by the girl child by the age of 5. Some parents believe that if you give a boy too much loving and hugging, you'll turn him into a sissy. However, exactly the opposite is true. Boys who receive a high quantity of physical contact from their parents grow up to be very strong, masculine, and self-confident. Boys who receive little or no physical contact from their parents grow up feeling insecure, unloved, and lacking in self-confidence. There's even a school of thought that says that much of the extra aggressiveness boys show when they're growing up is related to this lack of hugging and physical contact in comparison to that received by girls. In any case, you can never hurt the physical, emotional, or mental development of a child by giving him or her too much physical love and affection. Perhaps the most powerful way to tell a child that you really love him or her, that you consider the child to be a valuable and important and worthwhile, is focused attention. Focused attention is spending long stretches of unbroken time with the child. Children need to spend time with their parents. They need an opportunity to talk to their parents, to relate to them, just to be with them while they're growing up. The argument or debate over quality time versus quantity time is really ridiculous. The fact is that quality time is a function of quantity time. Quality time, those precious moments and experiences that you share with your child, come as the result of spending large quantities of time with the child. You can't just say, well, let's have some quality time. You have to be willing to invest long periods of time, perhaps many hours, in order to enjoy the moments of quality time that you desire. There's probably no better single way to build a high-quality relationship with your child than to schedule long, unbroken periods of time with the child during which you can just be together. Children need to communicate their thoughts and feelings to someone who's important to them, and the parent should be the most important person in their lives. If their parents don't take the time to sit quietly and patiently and listen, the child will begin to spend more and more time with his or her peer groups. The greatest influence that a person can exert in a teenager's life is to be the primary source of love, support, respect, and affection for the child. Children who don't receive this love and support from their parents will tend to seek it elsewhere, and the parents' influence over the child's behavior will diminish commensurately. Be sure to give your child lots of praise and encouragement for everything that they do, even moderately well. The rule is to praise and reinforce what you would like to see repeated. If the child comes home with grades ranging from A to D, compliment and praise the child on the good grades, and then encourage the child to do better in the areas where he or she is weak. Praise is like an elixir or tonic to the psychological health of a child. Your child's personality is so powerfully influenced by the amount of love and praise they receive from their parent. When you praise and encourage your child for his or her successes, you motivate him or her to go out and achieve even greater successes to get even more praise and encouragement. Praising a child also raises the child's self-esteem and self-confidence. Praise improves the child's self-image. Praise causes the child to believe in himself or herself and gives the child confidence to try even bigger and better things. At the same time, never use destructive criticism on your children. Children are extremely vulnerable to criticism from their parents. Criticism of any kind tears them up inside. They may not react on the outside, but inside they hurt terribly when they're subjected to criticism of any kind from the most important adults in their lives. Destructive criticism has probably done more to destroy more personalities than all the wars in human history. Most adult emotional and psychological problems stem back to a steady stream of destructive criticism from one or both parents. When a parent criticizes a child, the child feels unloved, undeserving, and insecure. The child feels rotten inside. Often, parents criticize their children in an attempt to increase their effectiveness. The parent's reasoning is this: if I criticize my child in this way, the child will straighten up and fly right. However, destructive criticism actually lowers self-esteem and lowers the child's self-concept. As the child's self-concept diminishes, the child's level of effectiveness decreases at the same time. Criticism of any kind simply causes the child's performance to deteriorate to the point where often the child will avoid the activity that sparked the criticism altogether. There's a wonderful little piece of advice by Dorothy Nolte which every parent should memorize. It is called, "Children Learn What They Live," and it goes like this. If a child lives with criticism, he learns to condemn. If a child lives with hostility, he learns to fight. If a child lives with ridicule, he learns to be shy. If a child lives with shame, he learns to feel guilty. If a child lives with tolerance, he learns to be patient. If a child lives with encouragement, he learns confidence. If a child lives with praise, he learns to appreciate. If a child lives with fairness, he learns justice. If a child lives with security, he learns to have faith. If a child lives with approval, he learns to like himself. If a child lives with acceptance and friendship, he learns to find love in the world. Whenever you're faced with a challenging situation involving your child, you need more than ever to ask the question, what's important here? And the right answer is always raising your child with high self-esteem and self-confidence is the true aim and real role of parenting. If you realize and remember that what's important here is not to be right and not to get the child to conform to your expectations, then you'll always be on the right track. Listen to your intuition. After you've read all the books and taken all the advice, the intuition of a loving parent is almost always superior to that of any other input. You will always have a tendency to know deep down inside what the right thing is for your child. And as long as your every decision and behavior is guided by love, you will always be doing the right thing. Dr. David McClelland of Harvard University did many years of research into achievement and how parenting styles affected achievement motivation in children. He found that there were two primary qualities in the households that produced high achievers, which were defined as boys and girls who began to achieve noteworthy things in their teens and early 20s. The first characteristic of the household and the parenting style that produced high achievers was that it was democratic. The opinions of the children were solicited and respected. The children were encouraged to give their input on family decisions from a very early age. The children were asked what they thought and how they felt about various family decisions. The children's input was as respected as that of the parents and was subject to considerable discussion. This doesn't mean that the children's opinions were necessarily acted upon. It simply means that the children's thoughts and ideas were taken into consideration. There's nothing that makes a child feel better than to be treated as an intelligent, thinking person by his or her parents. When you treat children as though they are really important and intelligent, they'll surprise you with the valuable contributions they can make. The second characteristic of parents who raised high achievers is that of positive expectations. High-achieving young people tend to grow up in homes where their parents are continually telling them how much they believe in them and how confident they are that they're going to do good work and do great things with their lives. When you say to a child, "You can do it," or "I believe in you," you encourage the child to believe in himself or herself, and you induce within the child a willingness to take on far more than the child would in the absence of your encouragement. Children who grow up in a climate of positive expectations always do better at everything they attempt. And now here's an important point. Positive expectations are not the same as demands. Many parents think that they're expressing positive expectations when, in fact, they are simply demanding that their children perform to a particular standard. A demand is always associated with conditional love, with the idea that if the child doesn't perform to expectations, the love and support of the parent will be withdrawn. It's very important for you to convey to your children that no matter how well or how poorly they do, you love them totally and unconditionally. If the child feels that his or her security and love will be withdrawn if he or she performs poorly, the child will tense up, and even if the child does well, the child will get no pleasure and no lasting satisfaction from his or her success. Another characteristic of families which produce high-achieving young people is the parents' attitude toward homework. In the homes that produce high achievers, the parents are very adamant about the importance of homework and the importance of doing well in school. They insist that their children do their school assignments on time. In fact, the single factor that accounts most for scholastic achievement in children is the attitude of their parents toward learning and their parents' involvement in the child's education. The key to excellent schoolwork was found to be where and when the homework was done. In the homes that produced high achievers, the homework was done at the family dinner table after dinner, with the television off, and in the presence of the parents. The parents volunteered to help the children with the homework and to familiarize themselves with their children's assignments. In the homes that produced low achievers, the parents sent the children to their rooms to do their homework, if they took any interest in the homework at all. When children are sent to their rooms to do their homework, they receive a message that the homework, and therefore the schoolwork, is not important. And children who did not learn to do good homework by the age of 10 very seldom learn to do good schoolwork later in their academic careers. If you want your children to perform at their best at school, you must get totally involved in every phase of their education. Life is the study of attention. We always pay most attention to that which we most value. When the parent pays close attention to the schoolwork and school activities of the child, the child begins to place a far higher value and importance on those activities himself. If the parent ignores the homework and schoolwork, the child gets the message that they are unimportant and also tends to ignore them. Children with high positive self-concepts always tend to do well in school. They don't engage in vandalism or other destructive activity. They don't do destructive things to their bodies. They're far more able to resist the negative influences of their peer groups. Children with high self-concepts, with high self-esteems, are more independent in their thinking. They think for themselves and they orient themselves towards success, achievement, and personal fulfillment. When your child feels terrific about himself or herself, he or she is less likely to give in to the temptations toward negative behaviors that seem to attract so many other children. One of the most important things that you can do to assure that you raise happy, healthy, self-confident children is to set a good example, to be a role model of the ideal person. Children learn largely by imitation during their formative years. They learn largely by watching you and listening to you and imitating your words and your behaviors. When you become a parent and you set yourself up as a role model, you no longer have the luxury to do and say whatever you want. If you want your children to grow up with good health habits, you must set an example by eating the right foods and making the right foods available in your household. If you want your children to avoid drinking, smoking, and other addictive habits, you need to set an example in everything that you do or say in these areas. If you want your children to spend more time reading rather than watching television, you need to set an example by reading at every opportunity. If you want your children to develop patience, calmness, poise, and self-control, you need to be a model of these behaviors, even under the most trying of circumstances. Children are always looking to their parents for cues on how to behave in various situations, and your position as a role model can exert as much or more influence than anything else you can possibly do in the lives of your children. They learn how to be loving adults by observing the love between their parents and how it's expressed. Probably the kindest thing that a man can do for his children is to love their mother, and the reverse is also true. Probably the kindest thing that a mother can do for her children is to love their father. Children learn about love by growing up in a household where love is freely expressed and shared. Most of us were brought up by parents who were unaware of some of the things that we've been discussing here. They made many mistakes with us, including and especially applying the use of destructive criticism and never fully expressing to us the amount of love and affection we required. Our natural tendency as adults and as parents is to repeat with our children the mistakes that were made with us. If you've made the mistake of using destructive criticism on your children, here's something that you can do for your child that will dramatically improve the quality of your family life starting immediately. After completing this session, go and gather your children around you and sit them down. Then, take a deep breath and apologize to them. Tell them that you're sorry for all the destructive criticism that you've ever used on them. Apologize for having ever said anything that might have diminished their self-esteem or made them feel bad about themselves. One of the main complaints of children of all ages is that their parents never say, "I'm sorry," or "I apologize," for mistakes that they've made or for hurtful things that they've said or done. Children are extremely sensitive to fairness from their parents, and they feel angry and hurt inside when they feel that they've been treated unfairly or accused unjustly for any reason. The purpose of your apologizing to your children is for you to accept complete responsibility for anything guilt-producing that you've ever said or done to them. When you apologize, you convey to your child that you're a human being, that you're not perfect. You're demonstrating that you have the character and the courage to admit when you are wrong and when you've been wrong in the past. Many parents refuse to apologize to their children for anything because they fear that their children won't respect them. They feel that they have to portray an image of infallibility or their children will take advantage of them. However, exactly the opposite is true. When you apologize to your child, you increase your child's love and respect for you, and you increase the likelihood that your child will cooperate with you in the future. When you don't apologize when you're wrong, you simply leave the child feeling angry and frustrated. The wonderful result of apologizing to your child Is it all the burden of guilt, negativity, and unworthiness that's built up from destructive criticism in the past is removed all at once? Many parents have seen their children transformed overnight by the simple exercise of sitting them down and saying, "I'm sorry for anything and everything that I have ever done or said that has ever hurt you in any way." Children who have been unreachable, distant, and estranged from their parents for months or even years have been reconciled almost immediately when the parent has had the courage and character to accept responsibility and to apologize. Once you've apologized, promise never to use destructive criticism again. And then, give your children permission to remind you when you slip from time to time. From then on, whenever you speak harshly, whenever you say or do something in anger, immediately take it back and say, "I'm sorry." I developed the habit with my children of saying, "I'm sorry, will you forgive me?" from the time my children were 1 or 2 years old. The wonderful thing is that children need and want their parents' love and respect so much that they will always forgive and forget. Once you've asked a child for forgiveness and the child forgives you, the slate is clean. When you apologize and say that you're sorry to your children, you give them permission to admit that they also make mistakes. They don't have to invest an enormous amount of their egos covering up and defending themselves as most adults do. When you demonstrate that you have the courage and character to admit your mistakes, you build courage and character in your children by example. They realize that they don't have to be perfect to be acceptable. They realize that they too can make mistakes. Remember, the most enduring relationship that you'll ever have will be with your children. This relationship will last for as long as you live. If you do it right, you'll reap the benefit of your efforts and your investment for all the days of your life. But if you don't do it right the first time, you very seldom get a second chance. Let me review quickly the key points in this session on how to raise super kids. First, remember that the primary role of parenting is to raise children with high self-esteem and self-confidence. This comes before anything else. Second, remember that children need a continuous flow of unconditional love, approval, and acceptance from their parents. This is the prime requirement for healthy mental, physical, and emotional growth and development. Third, tell your children you love them every single day, in words and in actions. Give them loving eye contact, warm physical contact, and focused attention. Spend lots of time with your children, taking them on walks, to the movies, on trips, and out on dates for lunch or dinner. Nothing tells a child that he or she is loved more than the parent spending lots of time with him or her. Fourth, remember, your children will be high achievers to the degree to which you get involved with their education and their homework, to the degree to which you express positive expectations that they'll perform at their very best, and to the degree to which you value their opinions and encourage them to contribute their thoughts and feelings to the life of your family. Fifth, remember that you are your child's primary role model. Your child, consciously and unconsciously throughout his or her entire life, will strive to be like you and to treat other people the way you treat him or her. If you treat your child with kindness, patience, love, respect, and approval, your child will grow up to be a fully functioning, fully mature, self-actualizing human being. What more could a parent ask for? Now here's an exercise for you. Ask yourself what it would be like to be your own child. Put yourself in the position of your child or your children, and then evaluate yourself as a parent. What are your strengths and your weaknesses? What do you do well, and what do you do poorly? What are some of the things that you do that might be causing your children to grow up with less self-esteem than you would like? And what can you do starting today to be a better and more loving parent?